attempts came from the north. OP-2 could hear the report of big rifles as OP-1's SEAL snipers hammered a couple of armed insurgents moving to attack. Soon, our OP-2 snipers observed three enemy fighters with AK-47s and an RPG rocket maneuvering through the streets toward the clearance teams. SEAL snipers engaged, hitting two of the three and sending the third running for cover. With those shots, the enemy had a good indication of where we were. Within the hour, the first burst of Muj machine gun fire snapped over the heads of the two SEALs positioned on the balcony. It was only the beginning, as the enemy sporadically engaged our building and probed our position. We knew their attacks would no doubt grow bolder as they pinpointed our position and the day progressed. The coordinate search operation proceeded with sporadic gunfire and a few warning shots fired. The SEAL sniper overwatch positions were able to help thwart any major attacks before they could materialize. The vigilant Team Bulldog soldiers, with their tanks at the ready, were also a substantial deterrent. Within about 2 hours of sunrise, the Army soldiers, along with Jocko and the small team of SEAL combat advisors, with their Iraqi soldiers, had cleared every building in the sector. Having accomplished their mission, they all moved safely back to Cop Falcon. It had been a relatively smooth operation, which, in such a dangerous neighborhood, right in the heart of South Central Ramadi, was somewhat miraculous. No American or Iraqi soldiers had been wounded or killed. That was a testament to the good planning and execution by the U.S. forces involved, and a tribute to the effectiveness of the SEAL sniper overwatch teams. With the coordinate search force back at Cop Falcon, both SEAL overwatch teams, OP-1 and OP-2, had accomplished our objectives. Our standard operating procedure, or SOP, dictated we remain in position until nightfall and then patrol back to base under cover of darkness when we could more safely move through the dangerous streets. A small element patrolling in broad daylight through enemy territory presented serious risk of almost certain contact. Enemy machine guns, RPG-7, shoulder-fired rockets, and IEDs could be utilized to deadly effect. But for OP-2, remaining in our current position also presented great risks. The building we held had substantial tactical vulnerabilities. The enemy knew where we were, and there was a high probability that with enough time, enemy fighters would mount a serious attack. Should they do so, we might very well take significant casualties and even find our position overrun by determined enemy fighters at close quarters. This presented quite a leadership dilemma. Again, I discussed options with my trusted LPO. We can stay where we are and wait until nightfall, or we can quickly break out of here and foot patrol back to Cop Falcon. Or we could call in the Bradleys for extract, though that could take some time. Bradley fighting vehicles provided protection from small arms fire behind their armor plating, and they brought significant firepower with a 25mm chain gun and 7.62mm coaxial machine gun. But they required some time to coordinate, to brief crews and drive to our position. Bradleys were loud, and the bad guys would hear them coming from some distance. This option would also expose the U.S. soldiers that crewed the vehicles to the substantial IED threat, as the roads in the vicinity of our position were extremely dangerous and had not been swept by the IED clearance teams. This could very well result in an IED strike, a deadly explosive buried in the road which might kill or seriously wound the soldiers inside. Were this to happen, it would require sending even more vehicles and troops in harm's way to extract casualties and downed vehicles. Calling in the Bradleys meant waiting for perhaps another half hour and would put Team Bulldog soldiers in significant danger. It would also endanger us riding in the vehicles through heavily IED'd streets. If we stayed in position until dark in accordance with SOP, we would almost certainly have to fend off increasingly violent enemy attacks for another 8 to 10 hours. Should those attacks exploit the significant weaknesses of our defenses, we might be pinned down and unable to depart without calling in massive fire support and putting more forces at even greater risk to bail us out. If we pulled out on foot immediately and quickly patrolled back to Cop Falcon, we would probably get shot at, but it would likely be a hasty attack that the Muj wouldn't have enough time to coordinate for maximum effectiveness. We could help mitigate that risk by moving quickly and utilizing misdirection in the streets and alleyways to prevent the enemy from predicting our exact route back to Cop Falcon so they couldn't set an ambush. Still, any gunfire we received, no matter how hasty, could certainly kill or horribly wound any of us. No options were good options. We had to choose the least bad option. "So what are we doing, LT?" asked the LPO. Time was ticking. I had to make a call. "We're pulling out," I decided. It was the least bad option. "Let's get packed up quick and break out of here as soon as we can." "Roger that," said the LPO. He passed the word to the rest of OP2, and everybody quickly gathered up their gear and double-checked to ensure nothing was left behind. Our OP2 radioman contacted OP1, the other sniper overwatch team, to tell them we were moving back on foot to the combat outpost. We also notified Team Bulldog soldiers back at Cop Falcon, where Jocko and a few of our SEALs with the clearance team had returned. For OP1, only a short 300-meter patrol from Cop Falcon, there was no such dilemma about what to do. They had an easy foot patrol back to Cop Falcon, covered by Cop Falcon's nearby tanks and heavy machine guns the entire way. OP1 radioed to us and OP2 that they too were pulling out. But OP1 made the mistake of not telling Jocko, which meant he could not coordinate the movement. "Roger that," our OP2 radioman responded to OP1's call. He relayed the information to the LPO and me. With our focus entirely on getting OP2 moving out in a hurry, we thought little of it. Every minute that passed by gave enemy fighters more time to coordinate a serious attack on our position. Within a few minutes, everyone was ready. We quickly briefed the team and emphasized that we needed to move fast. "Let's do this," was the consensus. Everybody knew we would likely get in a gunfight, but we wanted that gunfight to be on our terms, not the enemy's. With everything ready, we broke out of the building and emerged onto the street, our weapons pointed in all directions, ready for a fight. We quickly moved out and made our way through the streets, covering and moving as a team past Iraqi citizens who stared at us with some surprise. When aggressive men with guns pointed their weapons at them, the locals knew to keep their distance. Anyone who didn't avoid interfering with a heavily armed SEAL squad was certainly looking for trouble. Rapidly, we pushed past parked cars and piles of trash. Threats were everywhere in this urban environment. Every gate, door, and alleyway that we passed, the distant intersections down the street at ground level, and above us from every rooftop, balcony, and upstairs window. Each presented the possibility of well-armed Muj fighters ready to inflict horrible wounds or death upon us. Our tactic, which we had trained for, practiced, and utilized, was a fundamental one we called cover and move. Within our OP2 squad, we had four elements of smaller teams. One team covered, their weapons trained on threats, while the other team moved. Then those teams reverse roles. In this way, the teams leapfrogged in bounds, constantly utilizing cover and move to ensure we were prepared to fend off an attack as we maneuvered through the streets. For about 500 meters, OP2 moved along steadily, making our way back toward Cop Falcon. Then, all hell broke loose. Fully automatic gunfire erupted from the rear of our patrol. Insurgent fighters had followed us and heavily engaged us with AK-47s and PKC belt-fed machine guns, and rounds smashed into nearby walls and kicked up dust in the street right at our feet. Immediately, we responded with withering gunfire of our own. Our SEAL machine gunners were an awesome sight to behold, fearlessly laying down fire with deadly accuracy, even as enemy rounds impacted all around them. Like a well-oiled machine, we executed a center peel maneuver, a coordinated tactic where two columns systematically alternate shooting at the enemy and moving away in a safe direction until able to break contact. I lobbed a few 40mm grenades over the heads of our patrol and onto enemy positions to help keep their heads down as we bounded back. Our overwhelming fire quickly repulsed the enemy attack, and we continued to a street corner that provided additional cover, moving in a hurry toward Cop Falcon. Those courageous SEAL machine gunners had provided the cover fire that enabled us to move safely through the maelstrom. Within minutes, we covered the remaining distance to the cop and made our way past the Abrams tank guarding the entrance. We pushed past the concertina wire and concrete barriers into the relative safety of the U.S. Army combat outpost. We were breathing hard after running and gunning in the late morning heat with heavy gear, but we had all survived without a scratch. The LPO and I smiled and laughed at each other. We had just gotten ourselves into a solid gunfight on the street, hammered the enemy, and brought everyone back unscathed. It was awesome. We were fired up. But already back at Cop Falcon was our platoon chief. He had been with the cordon and search force and had returned earlier with Jocko and the rest of our small team of SEALs and the Iraqi soldiers. Chief wasn't happy. He pulled me aside. "What the hell were you guys doing out there?" the chief asked sternly. "What do you mean?" I asked, immediately getting defensive. The chief was a hell of a battlefield leader, extraordinary in a gunfight. With a long career of nearly 20 years, he was the most experienced SEAL in the task unit, and we highly valued his guidance and mentorship. Never one to shy away from a fight, he was courageous and always eager to close with and destroy the enemy. So why now was he critical of us, particularly my leadership on the battlefield? "What are you talking about?" I said. "Why didn't you leave the other sniper overwatch position, OP1, in place to cover your movement back here to Cop Falcon?" the chief asked. I thought about that for a moment. My initial defensiveness wore off. He was right. "No reason," I replied. Understanding his logic was absolutely correct. I realized my error. I was so focused on our own squad's dilemma, I didn't think to coordinate with the other team, OP1, to work together. We absolutely should have. This was the first rule in Jocko's Laws of Combat: cover and move. I had broken it. We had used cover and move within our own immediate OP2 team, but I had forgotten about the greater team and support available. We had operated independently, failing to support or help each other. Had we left OP1 in place, they would have had an excellent vantage from the high ground and could have covered our OP2 movement much of the way as we patrolled through the dangerous streets back to Cop Falcon. Once at the COP, we, OP2, could have provided additional cover for OP1 as they returned to Cop Falcon. It was foolishness not to work together. Though we were working in small teams with some distance between us, we weren't on our own. We were all trying to accomplish the same mission. The enemy was out there working against us, all of us. It was essential that we support each other and work together. One element must cover so that the other element could move. Our OP2 had gotten lucky this time around. Damn lucky. But my chief knew, and I now recognized, that we had taken a needless and foolish risk. We should have utilized every strength and tactical advantage possible against these ruthless enemy fighters occupying Ramadi. The most important tactical advantage we had was working together as a team, always supporting each other. It was a rude awakening for me. I had become so immersed in the details, decision points, and immediate challenges of my own team that I had forgotten about the other team, what they could do for us, and how we might help them. Going forward, I never forgot my chief's guidance. We utilized the principle of cover and move on every operation, all teams working together in support of one another. That realization and the lesson learned implemented no doubt saved lives, greatly reduced casualties, and enabled us to more effectively accomplish our mission and win. Principle: cover and move. It is the most fundamental tactic, perhaps the only tactic. Put simply, cover and move means teamwork. All elements within the greater team are crucial and must work together to accomplish the mission, mutually supporting one another for that singular purpose. Departments and groups within the team must break down silos, depend on each other, and understand who depends on them. If they forsake this principle and operate independently or work against each other, the results can be catastrophic to the overall team's performance. Within any team, there are divisions that arise. Often, when smaller teams within the team get so focused on their immediate tasks, they forget about what others are doing or how they can depend on other teams. They may start to compete with one another, and when there are obstacles, animosity and blame develops. This creates friction that inhibits the overall team's performance. It falls on leaders to continually keep perspective on the strategic mission and remind the team that they are part of the greater team and the strategic mission is paramount. Each member of the team is critical to success, though the main effort and supporting efforts must be clearly identified. If the overall team fails, everyone fails, even if a specific member of an element within the team did their job successfully. Pointing fingers and placing blame on others contributes to further dissension between teams and individuals. These individuals and teams must instead find a way to work together, communicate with each other, and mutually support one another. The focus must always be on how best to accomplish the mission. Alternatively, when the team succeeds, everyone within and supporting that team succeeds. Every individual and every team within the larger team gets to share in the success. Accomplishing the strategic mission is the highest priority. Team members, departments, and supporting assets must always cover and move, help each other, work together, and support each other to win. This principle is integral for any team to achieve victory. Application to business. "Those guys are horrible," said the production manager. He described a subsidiary company owned by their parent corporation on which his team depended to transport their product. "They can't get their jobs completed on schedule, and that prevents us from doing our jobs." Clearly, there were major issues between his field leaders, the frontline troops of his team, and those of the subsidiary company. Jocko and I stood before the class of a dozen mid-level managers seated at tables forming a U-shape in a conference room of the company's corporate headquarters. In the second session of a 12-month leadership training program, our presentation and discussion centered on the laws of combat. We solicited from each of the class participants specific leadership challenges that they currently faced. Jocko and I set about to help them solve these challenges through the application of the SEAL combat leadership principles they had just learned. The production manager explained that his team struggled to minimize downtime in their production, the times when they had to cease making product. These disruptions occurred for a variety of reasons, but they stopped product from moving to market, and every hour and day of downtime cost the company huge revenues and substantially impacted the bottom line. With this crew just getting up and running, there had been a steep learning curve. The production manager's team maintained an average downtime that was much worse than the industry standard. Such a glaring discrepancy was a major detriment to the company's profits. As a result, the production manager was under scrutiny and intense pressure to reduce downtime. The subsidiary company on which his production team depended became the major scapegoat to blame. "We spend a lot of our time waiting on them," the subsidiary company. "And that causes big problems and delays for us," said the production manager. "Those delays are impacting production and costing our company serious revenue." "How can you help this subsidiary company?" I asked the production manager. "I can't," he replied. "They don't work for me. We don't work for the same bosses. They are a different company." While he was right that they were a different company, both companies fell under the leadership of the same parent corporation. "Besides," he added with indifference, "they aren't my problem. I've got my own team to worry about." "It sounds like they are your problem," I responded. "In that sense," he agreed, "I guess they are." "What's worse," continued the production manager, now on a roll of bashing the subsidiary company, "because corporate owns them, we're forced to use their services." "What you just called the worst part should be the best part," Jocko responded. "You're both owned by the same corporation, so you both have the same mission. And that is what this is about, the overall mission, the overall team. Not just your team, but the whole team, the entire corporation, all departments within your company, all subsidiary companies under the corporation, outside contractors, the whole enterprise. You must work together and support each other as one team." "The enemy is out there," I said, pointing out the window to the world beyond. "The enemy is all the other competing companies in your industry that are vying for your customers. The enemy is not in here, inside the walls of this corporation. The departments within and the subsidiary companies that all fall under the same leadership structure, you are all on the same team. You have to overcome the us versus them mentality and work together, mutually supporting one another." Just as I had on the battlefield in Ramadi years before, the production manager was now so focused on his own department and its immediate tasks that he couldn't see how his mission aligned with the rest of the corporation and supporting assets, all striving to accomplish the same strategic mission. As I had done after some constructive guidance from my chief, the production manager must now be willing to take a step back and see how his production team's mission fit into the overall plan. "It's about the bigger strategic mission," I said. "How can you help this subsidiary company do their job more effectively so they can help you accomplish your mission and you can all win?" The production manager pondered this. He was still skeptical. "Engage with them," directed Jocko. "Build a personal relationship with them. Explain to them what you need from them and why, and ask them what you can do to help them get you what you need. Make them a part of your team," not an excuse for your team. Remember the stories Leif and I have told about relying on other units to support us? Those Army and Marine Corps units we worked with were not under our control. We had different bosses, but we depended on them and they depended on us. So we formed relationships with them and worked together to accomplish the overall mission of securing Ramadi. That's cover and move. You need to do the same thing here. Work together to win. The production manager was a driven leader who wanted his team to perform at the highest level. Now, he began to understand true teamwork. The proverbial light bulb went off in his head, and his attitude completely changed. If he wasn't working together with his subsidiary company, then he was failing his team. Over the next weeks and months, the production manager made every effort to positively engage with the subsidiary company, to communicate with them, and establish a better working relationship. He came to more fully understand the myriad challenges that impacted their timelines and caused delays, and what he could do on his end to help mitigate those issues. It wasn't that they were horrible, as he had initially surmised. They were operating with limited resources and limited manpower. Once he accepted that they weren't out to sabotage his team, he realized that there were steps that he and his team could take to help the subsidiary company become more efficient and fill in the gaps that had caused their delays. Instead of working as two separate entities against each other, they began to work together. With this shift in mindset, the production manager's encouragement enabled his field leaders to see the subsidiary company employees in a different light, not as adversaries, but as critical resources, part of the same greater team. Most important, the production team began to work with the subsidiary company's field team. Within a few months, the production team's field leaders encouraged key personnel from the subsidiary company to sit in on their coordination meetings. Very soon, the us versus them mentality had all but disappeared. They had broken through the silos and no longer worked against each other. The production team's downtime radically improved to industry-leading levels. They now work together as one team. Cover and move.
Chapter 6. Simple. Jocko Willink. Combat Outpost Falcon. Ramadi, Iraq. Into the fray. A massive explosion shook the walls of the building I was sitting in, right in the middle of Combat Outpost, or COP, Falcon. Adrenaline shot from my core, down my arms, and into my hands. Seconds later, another explosion rocked the compound. Soon the word spread. Mortars. Insurgents had lobbed 120mm mortar rounds smack dab into the center of COP Falcon with deadly accuracy. 120s were vicious. Each massive projectile carried 20-plus pounds of high explosives, wrapped in a half-inch thick steel jacket designed to throw jagged pieces of shrapnel in all directions, causing catastrophic wounds and death. The rounds had wounded several American soldiers at COP Falcon, one critically, who later succumbed to his injuries. A third 120mm mortar round hit the roof of the building I was in, but thankfully, for the soldiers nearby, it didn't explode. It was a dud. The mortars were alarmingly accurate, proving once again that the insurgents we were fighting were highly capable. As daylight dawned on this early morning, it was a grim reminder that this was dangerous territory, and we were sitting right in the middle of it. The night before, Leif and his SEALs from Task Unit Bruiser's Charlie Platoon had inserted from U.S. Marine Corps small unit riverine craft Cirque boats, manned by a great crew of highly motivated Marines. Charlie Platoon's SEALs, accompanied by an expert team from the 2nd U.S. Marine Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company, Anglico, with which they often worked closely, a small Army sniper team, and a partner force of Iraqi soldiers had hopped from the Cirque boats onto the riverbank. They quietly sneaked into this enemy-controlled neighborhood, one of the most violent areas of Ramadi. Our SEALs were the first U.S. boots on the ground. They led the opening salvo of this massive operation, involving hundreds of U.S. soldiers, tanks, and aircraft to establish a combat outpost literally in the center of enemy-controlled territory. Within minutes of their arrival, Charlie Platoon had killed an armed insurgent fighter patrolling the neighborhood in the early morning darkness. SEALs then seized and cleared the building complex that was to become Cop Falcon and held it for a few hours into the night, while SEAL snipers provided cover for the dozens of U.S. Army tanks and vehicles that followed the IED clearance teams along the road into the area. I had ridden in with the U.S. Army Battalion Task Force 137 Bandits, 1st Battalion, 37th Armored Regiment, 1st Armored Division, in an M2 Bradley fighting vehicle early in the morning before the sun had risen to link up with Leif and Charlie Platoon. My job was command and control of our SEALs. I would coordinate their efforts with Task Force Bandits soldiers. Shortly after our arrival, Charlie Platoon's SEALs turned the buildings they had cleared and occupied over to the U.S. Army Company Commander of Team Bulldog and other soldiers of Task Force 137 Bandit. Then, Leif and most of the SEALs pushed out to a building a few hundred yards down the road to set up another sniper position. I remained at Cop Falcon to coordinate their movements, providing overwatch for the Army engineers as they built Cop Falcon into a defensible position. This required extensive planning, coordination, and hours of intense labor to haul and emplace some 30,000 sandbags, over 150 concrete barriers, and hundreds of yards of concertina wire. It had been a long night. The jarring impact of the deadly mortars was our morning wake-up call. There had been intermittent small arms fire throughout the night, but no serious firefights. The mortars were the first real attack that did damage and inflicted casualties. Not that it slowed down the operation. The courageous Army engineers had a job to do, and they kept working, swinging hammers and operating heavy machinery even as the bullets flew. They were brave soldiers, to a man. As the hot Iraqi sun rose above the dusty city streets and people awakened, so did the bulk of the enemy fighters. I soon heard the loud report of SEAL sniper rifles from Charlie Platoon's position on the high ground in a four-story apartment building a few hundred meters down the street. Leif relayed to me via radio that his SEAL snipers had engaged enemy fighters maneuvering to attack Cop Falcon. But building the combat outpost in enemy territory was only the beginning. There was more to be done. One of the primary objectives in placing this combat outpost in the heart of enemy territory was to show the local populace that we, the coalition of American and Iraqi soldiers, were here to stay, and that we did not fear the Al-Qaeda insurgents who had controlled most of Ramadi unchecked for years. This could not be accomplished by sitting and hiding inside heavily reinforced bases. The troops had to go out and into the neighborhood surrounding the cop. They had to conduct a type of operation so straightforward, its name requires almost no explanation, a presence patrol. It required a group of soldiers to push into enemy-held areas to establish their presence among the populace. In this situation, the mission called for a combined operation, including Iraqi and American soldiers working together. A U.S. Army officer from a military transition team, teams of U.S. soldiers or Marines, built and deployed to train and combat advise Iraqi soldiers, known as MITs, planned to lead a group of Iraqi soldiers out into the neighborhood. The MIT leader was very excited to get out on patrol with his Iraqi soldiers and test their mettle. He had been working and training with them for several months in another city in northern Iraq, and had conducted some fairly benign patrols and combat operations with them. But this was Ramadi. There would be nothing easy or benign about patrolling into these neighborhoods. Here, the enemy was determined, well-armed, and ready. They would be waiting to attack and kill any U.S. soldier, SEAL, Marine, or Iraqi soldier that they could. My immediate discussions with the MIT leader revealed he did not fully appreciate the dangers that lay in store. I was also concerned that his Iraqi soldiers might not yet be ready for the intense street fighting that was likely to take place in this sector of Ramadi. so I assigned a small group of our SEALs to accompany him and his Iraqi soldiers as command and control to help coordinate any help should they need it. I stood with one of Charlie Platoon's young SEAL officers, who would lead the SEAL element accompanying the Iraqi soldiers, as the MIT leader strolled over to us and pulled out his battle map to brief us on the route he intended for the patrol. He outlined a path that snaked through the treacherous city streets and stretched clear across south central Ramadi over to the next U.S. combat outpost to the east, Cop Eagle's Nest. This was nearly 2 kilometers through some of the most hostile territory in Iraq, held by a determined and vicious enemy. None of the roads had been cleared by the U.S. minesweeping teams, so no doubt massive IEDs laid buried along the route. That meant U.S. armored vehicles and firepower could not get to the patrol along much of the leader's planned path without putting the vehicles at huge risk should he and his Iraqis, and now our SEALs, get pinned down. Beyond that, his planned route passed through battle space owned by different American units, including 2 U.S. Army companies, another Army battalion, and a U.S. Marine Corps company. Each had unique standard operating procedures and utilized separate radio nets. That would mean coordinating with all these units prior to launch and setting up contingency plans for help should something go wrong. The amount of water needed for such a long trek in the Iraqi summertime heat that exceeded 115 degrees Fahrenheit, along with the massive amount of ammunition required to penetrate so deeply into enemy territory, added up to far more than anyone could effectively fight with or carry. Even in a much more permissive or peaceful environment, the MIT leader's plan for patrol across battle space owned by different units would be extremely complex. To try to accomplish this in the worst neighborhoods of Ramadi, the most hazardous battlefield in Iraq, was just plain crazy. I listened to the plan. When I understood the overall idea and the complexity it involved, I finally commented, "Lieutenant, I appreciate your motivation to get out there and get after it, but perhaps, at least for these first few patrols, we need to simplify this a little bit." "Simplify?" asked the MIT leader incredulously. "It's just a patrol. How complex can it get?" I nodded my head respectfully. "I know it's just a patrol," I said, "but there are some risks that can compound when working in an environment like this." "It's nothing I haven't trained these Iraqis on," he responded confidently. While I appreciated his confidence, I knew it was hard for the lieutenant to fully grasp the complexities of the mission he was planning when he had not executed missions in such a hostile environment. "I know you've trained them well, and I'm sure your Iraqi soldiers are a good group," I said, knowing it was likely they had never been in a serious firefight together. "But let's look at what you have here. This route will take you through 3 separate battle space owners, 2 Army and 1 Marine Corps. It will take you into areas that are known to be heavily IED'd, which will make any type of support, like casualty evacuation or fire support from tanks, extremely risky. They may not even be able to get to you at all. Even though you've worked extensively with all these Iraqi soldiers, my SEALs haven't worked with them at all. So do you think, at least for this first patrol, we can simplify this a little by cutting down the distance and keeping the entire patrol inside battle space owned by this company, Team Bulldog?" "That will only be a few 100 meters out," the MIT leader objected. "I know," I replied. "I know it seems short, but let's just keep it simple to start, and we can expand as we get more experience." I knew that one real operation in this environment for the MIT leader would convince him that simplicity was key. After some further discussion, the MIT leader agreed to do a much shorter, simpler route. Soon after, the MIT leader, his Iraqi soldiers, and a small contingent of SEALs gathered around to go through an OPORD, which is the operations order, the pre-mission brief that explains the details of the operation to the members of the team. It was this Iraqi element's first patrol in Ramadi, and despite the mortars that had hit and wounded several U.S. soldiers and the constant sound of gunfire in the background, they didn't seem too concerned. Neither did the MIT leader. Neither, for that matter, did my SEAL element leader. Everyone seemed pretty nonchalant about the patrol. I knew that contact with the enemy was highly likely, if not imminent. After the brief, they split up to do some final preparations, grab water, check ammo and weapons, and go over individual instructions. I went in and covered the route again with the SEAL element leader, noting landmarks such as easily recognizable buildings, unique intersections, water towers, and mosque minarets, which could be used as reference points. We also looked at the battle map, with an overlay of numbers assigned to every building in this sector of the city. The young SEAL officer and I reviewed the building numbers of prominent buildings in the area so we could better communicate both the patrol's position and the position of the enemy should we need to do so. The combined element then mustered to form up and begin the patrol. I had already coordinated with Leif to have his element of SEALs in their sniper overwatch position in the four-story building 300 meters outside the perimeter of Kop Valken, cover the movement of the presence patrol. With precision sniper fire, machine guns, rockets, and an elevated fighting position, Leif's element could effectively protect the movement of the patrol through the streets. That would help mitigate the risk of enemy attack. I watched closely the attitude of the troops getting ready to head out. It wasn't real for them yet. Finally, I walked up to the young SEAL leader, looked him in the eye, and said, "You are going to get contacted out there. It will happen quick. Stay sharp. Understand?" My serious tone impacted the young SEAL lieutenant, who nodded slowly and confirmed, "Got it, sir. Will do." With that, I stepped back and watched the patrol head out the gate of Kop Valken and into enemy territory. Curious as to how long it might take for enemy fighters to attack, I pressed start on my stopwatch as the patrol stepped off. This was the first overt presence patrol into this section of South Central Ramadi by coalition soldiers in months, perhaps years. Task Unit Bruiser's Delta Platoon, working in an adjacent sector across the city, had for the past 2 months been attacked by enemy fighters on almost every single patrol. I monitored the radio at Kop Valken, tracking the patrol's progress. Suddenly, gunfire rang out, echoing across the city blocks. An enemy AK-47 in the near distance. A SEAL machine gunner answered. It was immediately joined by dozens of other weapons that let loose a hellacious barrage of fire, which confirmed to me that these were my SEALs in contact. There was no other unit that unleashed such fury when the shooting started. I looked at my watch. It had been 12 minutes since the patrol stepped off from Kop Valken. From my position at the Kop, I listened to the radio calls. They were broken and jumbled, weakened by the thick concrete walls of city buildings that radio waves could not always penetrate. The shooting continued. It was a substantial firefight. Volleys of gunfire rattled back and forth between the patrol and enemy fighters. More garbled communications. I recognized the voice of the SEAL element leader with the patrol, but couldn't make out what he was saying. Leif, on the high ground with direct line of sight to both of us, had good radio communications both with the SEAL leader on the ground with the patrol and with me. Leif received a situational update from the patrol. He and the young SEAL element leader both communicated with a clear, calm voice, despite the chaos of the situation, just like we had trained. Leif relayed the report to me. 2 friendlies wounded. Need Kazovac and fire support. In order to quickly get tanks and Kazovac vehicles out to help the patrol, I needed to get direct radio communications with the SEAL officer in the patrol and confirm their position. I quickly sprinted to the top of the largest building on Kop Valken, stood up, and extended my radio antenna for maximum reception. I keyed up my radio and tried to reach the patrol. "Red Bull, this is Jocko." "Go, Jocko," responded the SEAL leader with the patrol in a calm voice. We now had direct radio communications. "What do you got?" I asked. "2 wounded. Need Kazovac and fire support," he responded. Just as he had been taught, simple, clear, concise information, exactly what was needed. "Roger. Confirm your location," I said. "Building Juliet 5-1, he replied. "Are all your troops in Juliet 5-1? I asked. Affirm, all friendly troops in Juliet 5-1, he confirmed. Roger. Tanks and Kazovac inbound, I notified him. I sprinted back down to the first floor into the makeshift talk where Team Bulldog's company commander stood waiting for the information he needed to get his troops and tanks moving out. What's going on out there, sir? The company commander asked. What do they need? Calmly, I relayed to him the critical info. They need fire support and Kazovac in vicinity of building Juliet 5-1. All friendly personnel are consolidated inside building Juliet 5-1. There are two wounded. I stepped to the huge battle map hanging on the wall next to us and guided my finger to building Juliet 5-1 on the map. Right here, I said and pointed to ensure everybody was clear. Got it, sir, answered the company commander. I'll take a section of tanks and an M113 to building Juliet 5-1. All friendlies are located in that building. Two wounded. Check, I replied, confirming he had all the information correct. He quickly flew out the door toward his tank, briefed his troops, and personally mounted up. He and his men would brave the dangerous IED-laden streets to get the SEALs, American MIT advisors, and Iraqi troops pinned down under enemy attack. They would do their utmost to save the lives of their wounded.